You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Let's go ahead and get started. Thank you so much for coming to this event on Turkey today. I'm seeing a lot of familiar faces in the audience, which is wonderful. I was going to say it's an incredibly timely day to be talking about Turkey and the West. We just had a piece come out in the Washington Post by the editorial staff. We have Erdogan meeting with some of his European interlocutors today. But then again, pretty much every day is a timely day to be talking about Turkey if you follow it as regularly as we do. So I think this is going to be a fantastic discussion. We have an excellent panel. I'm very excited to be here. I'm Liesl Hintz. I'm an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies, just next door. We actually have a little bit of a SAIS mafia here today, a couple of SAIS associates. So here we have with me Ambassador Eric Edelman, who is a Robert Hartog Distinguished Practitioner in Residence at SAIS, and of course, former ambassador. Amanda Sloat here from Brookings, a Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Center on U.S. and Europe, and also, of course, former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Southern Europe and Eastern Mediterranean Affairs. We have, again, another SAIS colleague, Steve Sabo, who is a Senior Fellow at the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies.
Here.
Oh, hello. And then we also have, of course, Kemal Kirishci, who is the TUSIAD Senior Fellow here at Brookings, who has just published a fabulous new book, Turkey and the West, which I would highly recommend that you purchase. It might be available for purchase here, but it's certainly worth getting an excellent set of insights into Turkey relations with the West. So we're going to sort of be talking about the challenges in how does the West deal with Turkey? Has Europe lost Turkey? Is there anything salvageable in this relationship? What are the tools that governments have when they're trying to influence what Turkey is doing? Is it perhaps a bit of hubris to think that the U.S. or Europe can actually influence what Turkey is doing? What role does domestic politics play in these relations and in sort of how Erdogan's government views its relations with the U.S. And Europe specifically? So I want to start with, we have a really nice diverse set of views on these issues, which I think is going to be really valuable for our discussion. So I want to start with Ambassador Edelman first, and just a very general question to sort of start off the discussion. What do you think are the main challenges, the most sort of stubborn sticking points in the U.S.-Turkey relationship at this point? And what would you see as the appropriate tools for the U.S. to try to overcome those?
Thank you, Liesl. It's great to be here.
Very good to be on a panel with you again.
Good to be with you again. It's good to be with this very distinguished group of Turkey watchers. I think the predominant challenge that we have is that almost everything that is occurring in U.S.-Turkish relations, and I would argue more broadly Turkey's relations with the West, although I defer to Kemal on that, is driven by Erdogan's domestic political agenda, which is very much a personal political agenda, and which is essentially about finishing the erection of a very personalistic, quote, presidential regime. Since the term limits have been removed in China for Xi Jinping, and I noted with interest in the aftermath of the Russian election that a discussion has begun in Russia about whether it's even worth having additional elections in Russia since the Russian people have voted overwhelmingly to make President Putin their president. I would not at all be surprised after 2019 if we get some discussion of that kind going in Turkey. If you just look at the changes that are being proposed today in the electoral law in Turkey, this is clearly a set of changes that is meant to allow the regime to fiddle the vote and control the vote going forward. Understandably, because they had to do that in the spring of last year for the referendum creating the executive presidency. So I think the first thing to recognize is all of this is driven by his domestic political agenda. The outstanding issues we have, I think, are obviously a difference of view about how to manage the situation in Syria, which is a very serious issue that requires, I think, some give and take on both sides, which I think could happen under the right circumstances. Practice of hostage diplomacy by the Erdogan regime against the U.S., Pastor Brunson, but also U.S. Foreign Service nationals who have been imprisoned in Turkey under, pardon the pun, totally trumped-up charges, and the export or the attempt to export the kind of thuggery and illegality that's gone on in Turkey to the U.S., including here at Brookings, by the way, mm-hmm. by the president's bodyguards. And I think the final thing I think that is on the agenda, I mean, obviously the use of Incirlik Air Base is very important, but the final thing that's on the agenda, in my view, is the fact that the Erdogan regime ceaselessly stokes anti-Americanism, particularly in the press controlled by the president's in-laws and other cronies. And I just think there's very little prospect for this relationship to prosper in the long run as long as that continues. Now, what are the tools at our disposal? I think for too long, and this is a bipartisan, nonpartisan, self-critical comment, going back to the arrival of the AKP regime in 2002, the United States, in successive administrations, has created a situation of what I would call political moral hazard by essentially saying that the relationship with Turkey is just too important to allow it to be distracted by domestic issues, human rights, rule of law, things like that. And I think that has turned out to be a terrible mistake. We've operated on the assumption that if we treat Turkey like an ally, Turkey will start acting like an ally. But the famous Einstein quotation about, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result, that's where we are. Through successive administrations, we have not been able to do that and make Turkey actually behave like an ally. They're not behaving like a normal ally. And I think, the tools we have at our disposal, we can get into that in more detail, but I think it's more a question of what our fundamental orientation is. And my view is we should stop pretending that they're going to behave like an ally to try and, warn them off buying S-400s by offering to sell them other U.S. military goods and take a very transactional approach with them. The Russians have done that very effectively with Turkey in the last year or two. So have the Germans. And I don't think there's any reason why we can't do it as well.
Okay. So, Amanda, I kind of want to move to you on this because the paper that you've just published with Brookings takes a little bit of a different approach. So rather than kind of seeing, we tried to treat Turkey as an ally, they're not behaving like one, you sort of take this approach of we can kind of practice principled engagement. Can you talk a little bit about how that's different from the approach that Ambassador Edelman outlined and why you think that that's actually possible?
Sure. I agree with Ambassador Edelman's general laydown of the challenges that we're facing. And in the paper I wrote, I laid out what I see are the three main baskets of options that people have been discussing in terms of tools of responding to Turkey. One of those, as he laid out, is this idea of a transactional approach. I think some of that is happening to a certain extent just in terms of realpolitik. I actually think the EU-Turkey refugee deal, in a sense, was an example of that. I mean, if you want to be very cynical, it was the EU paying Turkey to keep the refugees in its borders, and it was Turkey trying to extract as high of a price as possible to keep them there. And it included things like visa liberalization, EU accession, which were not actually part of the fundamental problem at hand in terms of refugees. The problem that I have with the transactional approach is I think there's limits to that, especially for Western countries that want to hold true to principles of rule of law and good governance. Ambassador Edelman mentioned hostage diplomacy, which Turkey is seeking to engage in and is obviously highly problematic. But if you start to go down that road, you run the risk of playing the game on Turkey's terms. And I think really to deal with the issue of hostage diplomacy, you need to get at questions in Turkey of rule of law and good governance and an independent judiciary. And frankly, if Western countries stay true to rule of law, we're never going to win at a game of transactional politics with Turkey. And I think for Western countries, we need to preserve this focus on rule of law. So briefly, another approach, and I don't think anybody up here is going to be advocating that, but is this idea of abandonment. It's the idea of kicking out of Turkey, out of NATO in its most extreme form. That, I think, is a problem if we think Turkey is difficult to deal with inside NATO. I think Turkey is going to be even more challenging to deal with outside NATO. This approach also gets applied to the idea of EU accession and this debate over whether or not we should stop EU accession since it clearly isn't going anywhere. My argument has been to at least preserve the process because it provides a framework within which to deal with Turkey. It's the lens through which the EU makes any criticisms about Turkey's governance and rule of law. And I think we also need to preserve the possibility of EU accession in a period when we have a government that is practicing more effective democracy and rule of law. So finally, that comes back to the question you posed, which is my third set of policy tools, and the one that I would prefer is this idea of constructive and principled engagement. I think that we need to do this in several ways. One, I think we need to widen the aperture on the issues that we deal with Turkey. I think especially from the U.S. perspective, over the last several years, our relationship has become almost exclusively focused on Syria and counterterrorism issues. For the EU, of course, there's been the focus on refugees. And I think a relationship that is founded almost solely on security issues is not the appropriate grounding for a relationship, and it's something we need to widen the aperture on much more. You are seeing the EU and Germany doing this in terms of having conversations with the Turks on a much wider set of issues. I think we need to deal with a wider set of actors within Turkey beyond just the president. I think the recent engagement by outgoing Secretary of State Tillerson, Defense Secretary Mattis with their counterparts was a useful part of this. I think we need to look at the economic aspects of the relationship, and Steve may talk about this more, but I think that's where Germany in particular has had the most leverage with Turkey is on the economic side. It's been an underdeveloped area of U.S. and Turkey relationship for years. There's been discussion within the EU about looking at upgrading the customs union, which I think that actually provides an interesting set of tools for the EU to be able to give Turkey some of what it wants in terms of deeper economic integration, while at the same time locking them into a rules-based framework that's going to require more work on their part in terms of good governance. Final point I would make on engagement is there is a need to deal with civil society. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be careful in terms of how we talk about this and have a certain humility in this idea of democracy promotion and what we can do from the outside in terms of Turkey's domestic politics, because I feel that ultimately is a fight for the Turkish people. But I do think there is a utility in engaging with a broad section of Turkish civil society from a range of sectors and continuing to support those within Turkey who want to see the country going in a different direction.
Okay. Just a quick follow-up. So would you see, given sort of what Ambassador Edelman was talking about and the domestic politics of this, and we know that we have local and national and presidential elections coming up in 2019, we know that Erdogan has kind of staked his political career on being president, on having a presidential system. Can a strategy of principled engagement be implemented now, or is this something that, you know, any sort of outreach that the U.S. makes to Turkey, Turkey can kind of push back against because this anti-Western nationalism is such a powerful mobilizing tool for elections?
I think things are going to be difficult for the next year or until whenever elections are, partly because of the very reason that Ambassador Edelman mentioned, which is this tendency in Turkey to try and rally support within the nationalist base by fomenting anti-Western sentiment with the United States and the EU being very easy rhetorical tools. Mm-hmm. And for the U.S., I think from Turkey's perspective, they see, or at least Erdogan sees, internal and external threats as largely being the fault of the United States,
yes,
with Fethullah Gulen living in Washington, who he blames for the 2016 coup and wants the U.S. to extradite, and also the U.S. decision to partner with the YPG in Turkey or in Syria, which is affiliated with the PKK, which is also fomenting threats there. So I'm under no illusion that the next year is going to be easy. But frankly, I don't think we have much choice other than continuing to engage with them. I do think that the United States government needs to be more vocal about what we're seeing in terms of some of the human rights and the rule of law abuses in Turkey. I think President Trump and Vice President Pence so far have been very quiet on this, as has the White House generally. You've had the State Department and the embassy be a little bit more forward-leaning, but I do think that, again, to stay consistent with our own principles and values, to send a message to the people and the civil society activists in Turkey, we do need to be more vocal about the things that we're seeing that are problematic.
Okay. Ambassador Edelman, how would you respond to Amanda's take on this? Particularly, so we have sort of a suggestion of where the U.S. should be going in terms of its relationship with Turkey. But with the nomination of Pompeo as Secretary of State, someone who has tweeted that Turkey is an Islamic totalitarian dictatorship, what kind of signals is the U.S. sending to Turkey?
And I believe he deleted that tweet.
It might have been deleted, but you know, tweets, they last forever in cyberspace. So how do you respond to that proposed strategy, and are we sending signals that might inhibit that kind of strategy in the future?
You know, I agreed with a lot of what Amanda said, and I don't think the differences between us are that great. But so let me just make a couple of observations. One, I completely agree with Amanda that we should not be abandoning rule of law. I think that's actually the most important thing we ought to be talking about with regard to Turkey, both because how it affects the issues between us, but also how it affects the domestic situation in Turkey, because I quite agree with Amanda that ultimately this is, you know, the future of Turkey is for Turks to decide, not for the U.S. So I'm not suggesting that in being transactional because they're taking hostages, we should take hostages. Mm-hmm. But there are things that you can do that don't necessarily put you outside the bounds of the rule of law that allow you to, create more leverage for dealing with things like taking our FSNs, prisoner. So, Turkey has a lot of consulates here in the United States. I think if we closed the one in L.A., that would impose a lot of pain on Turkey and on people close to the president. This is very similar, I think, in some sense, to how we deal with other kleptocracies like Russia. So I'm not suggesting we abandon the rule of law. I'm not suggesting we take hostages in order to trade hostages. But I think we can take things of value to Turkey hostage, if you will, completely within the rubric of rule of law. Second, although I'm all in favor of engagement, I spent 30 years as a Foreign Service officer, I'm all in favor of diplomacy, we shouldn't kid ourselves that Secretary Tillerson or Secretary Pompeo, or Secretary Designate Pompeo, when he's confirmed, dealing with Foreign Minister Çavuşoğlu, or Jim Mattis dealing with the Minister of Defense, matters in a system where the only decision maker who matters is the president. I think this was actually one of the fundamental flaws of the Russia reset, the idea that we could engage with Medvedev, we could engage with Lavrov, and somehow this was going to, create more openings for policy. I'm not against it. We ought to do it. I would say, actually, we ought to do it in a format that we've used with other countries where we have the SecDef and the Secretary of State together, because I think in this administration in particular, there's a problem of conflicting messages, and I think you want to have a unified message. I think any policy towards Turkey that is not marked by a uniform message coming out of the United States government is going to fail. And so I think that, that is the other piece. And then I would just say on abandonment, I actually agree with Amanda about maintaining the EU process as moribund as it is, because it does provide a framework, including a framework for good governance. I think we ought to remind our Turkish friends that President Erdogan himself at one point said that the Copenhagen criteria should be renamed the Ankara criteria, because those are things that Turkey should want to do for itself, not just to become a member of the EU. But I also think the abandonment, with all due respect to Amanda, I think the abandonment option is really a straw man, because nobody is seriously, I think, recommending that Turkey be kicked out of NATO. There's not even a mechanism for doing it. So Turkey is a NATO member. It's why we ultimately have to try and get this relationship back onto some kind of even keel. The question is how best to do that.
I think one of the troubles with, you know, applying pressure, whether it's through sanctions or other kind of mechanisms to try to compel or deter or change the behavior of Turkey, is that particularly given these upcoming elections, that can just kind of be fueled, or that can fuel that anti-Western rhetoric. And when you are squeezing, you know, as targeted as your sanctions are, when you end up maybe even by trickle down squeezing the Turkish, you know, Turkish society in general, then you have difficulty in that kind of outreach to civil society that Amanda was talking about. If you kind of disenfranchise or disenchant the population because you're taking steps against their government.
But Liesl, can I just say please, to that point, we're being accused of doing this anyway.
Exactly. Right.
So we might as well actually, you know, get some juice out of the squeeze because we're being blamed for it anyway.
Okay. All right. So I want to kind of bring Europe more explicitly into the discussion. So I want to turn to Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. So how do you think that the challenges that the U.S. faces vis-a-vis Turkey and Europe faces vis-a-vis Turkey? I mean, obviously, we've got, you know, geographical differences and the refugee crisis and so forth. Is there a fundamental difference in the challenges that are facing these actors trying to reach out to Turkey? Do they have maybe, is there a differential in their ability to resolve those differences? Is the EU doing better at resolving those differences? How would you sort of respond to that?
Thanks. I think the EU has a bigger leverage than the United States. And in some ways, it's also ironic, paradoxical, because when we go back to the 1990s, we see a United States that tried really hard and lean on the European Union, too, to engage Turkey in an exercise that opened up the prospects of membership. But the way the EU enjoys leverage is through economics. Mm-hmm. Right now, 48% of Turkey's exports go to the to the European Union. Whereas even though Erdogan now and then brings up Russia, Iran, and China as alternatives to the West, the way he puts it, only 6% of Turkey's overall exports go to these three countries. The challenge here is that Eric and Amanda brought up the economic dimension, is that even though there has been this long-standing alliance between the U.S. and Turkey going all the way back, from my point of view, to 1946, for reasons that really puzzle me, a trade relationship and economic relationship between these two countries have not taken off. The U.S. has much of a greater trade relationship with Vietnam, for example, a country with which the U.S. was at once at war. And that deserves some addressing. The European Union also enjoys leverage over Turkey for historical reasons, but also for the fact that there are Turkish communities in the European Union, and there is also many Europeans that until very recently, until this hostage diplomacy issue emerged, pour into Turkey, and that generates a lot of tourism revenue. And then when you have such a close trade relationship, there's also companies that invest in Turkey. Two-thirds of Turkey's foreign direct investments come basically from the European Union, and with that comes also technology. And I think this is what is explaining why Erdogan, before boarding his plane to Varna, Bulgaria, where this meeting between top EU officials and him is going to take place, he did kind of throw around rose leaves, was it the expression?
Rose petals. Mm-hmm.
Rose petals around. It's amazing. And I think this is basically driven by a recognition that the Turkish economy is not doing as well as statistics on surface mm-hmm. seem to be suggesting. And I agree with the way in which this anti-Americanism, anti-Westernism has been underlined in the context of Turkish politics and the way Erdogan mobilizes his nationalist base. But I think Erdogan is also aware through his immediate cabinet members that there are a lot of companies out there who are employing people, who are paying social security contributions on a monthly basis, constantly remind, maybe often in a very shy way, Erdogan that they need this market in the European Union. Now, one last remark I'd like to make is that I agree with all that has been said, but when I look at the 1990s and the early part of the 2000s, the European Union is not the lighthouse towards which Turkey and other countries of the region were aspiring to move. And that is weakening the traditional leverage that the European Union has enjoyed. The fact that the European Union is beginning to have problems, at least with some of its membership, with respect to the very, very principles that we're talking about, the rule of law and liberal values, you know, I need not mention specific countries here, is coming back into Turkish domestic politics, where politicians, including Erdogan, are kind of abusing it or exploiting these realities. And lastly, there are inconsistencies. There are inconsistencies in U.S. foreign policy and some of the promises made to Turkey in Syria, but also on the part of the European Union, a failure to recognize, and Amanda in her paper does a great job in discussing how there needs to be greater attention to the kinds of threats and difficulties that Turkey is failing, which the European Union is. So the chemistry out there is not one, but I'd like to argue, as I do in my book, that Turkey has nowhere else to go but the West. And I think this is slowly and surely sinking in amongst the decision makers in Turkey, including the president, even if there is a bitterness towards this reality.
I think the economic aspect is a really important one when we think about some of the shifts in Turkish foreign policy. And we've seen some, you know, 180-degree shifts very quickly. Particularly I'm thinking of, and perhaps it's because it happened around the same time or sort of on the same day, of Turkey's rapprochement with Russia and with Israel, when there was a recognition that the economic sanctions and the lack of Russian tourists and Turkey's desire to be part of a natural gas hub and potentially cooperate with Israel, we saw, you know, very vitriolic relationships kind of soften. So I think that's a really important aspect to consider. So if we're looking at, you know, how the EU can potentially reach out to Turkey or improve the relationship, how would you respond to an argument that says that the EU is kind of complicit in allowing the rise of the AKP in the first place? In sort of, you know, having a very warm relationship with the AKP when it first comes to power, is there anything that it could have done differently, potentially, in terms of maybe sending mixed signals, in terms of whether it could be a member?
You know, there's a lot of this discussion on this. The extension of that discussion is also whether AKP and Erdogan fooled the European Union. But I look at it somewhat differently. And recently I've been doing a lot of traveling, and I'm getting this opportunity to talk to a lot of European diplomats behind closed doors, and also sometimes in public meetings. And the common denominator to this experience is a recognition that the European Union made a mistake. A mistake starting with Nicolas Sarkozy's position, Angela Merkel's to some extent. But to me, symbolically, the biggest mistake came in December 2006 when the European Council decided to freeze negotiations on 8 chapters because Turkey would not extend the customs union to Cyprus. And symbolically, this is around when you begin to see a slowing down of the reform process and cynicism beginning to creep into the Turkish debate and discussions on the European Union. So moving forward, it's going to be very important to extract lessons from that. I am tempted to argue you cannot reconstruct history, But there is a dynamic there. And I remember how in 2010 and 11, one minister of the cabinet of the time, whom I would like to think was a very enthusiastic supporter of Turkey's EU aspirations and membership desires, said simply to me, "Prof, the European Union doesn't sell anymore in the villages and towns of Anatolia where we go to talk to." And that, I think, is a function of the European Union leaders having second thoughts there. And 2010 also happens to be when public support for the European Union in Turkey hit rock bottom of 33% compared to where it was in 2003-04 at 74-76%, depending what survey you do. But support for the European Union is picking up again. And I'm sure Erdogan is looking over his shoulder and taking note of these. And this picking up, I would argue, is a function of the state of Turkey's neighborhood, but also of economics. Yet, when in these surveys the public is asked whether you believe Turkey would one day become a member of the European Union, the percentages are extremely low compared to what it was in 2004-2005.
I think this point about Erdogan's, you know, spreading roses to the EU or kind of noticing that perhaps support for the EU is picking up is really indicative of what I kind of think of him as, this, like, you know, nimble but sort of erratic tactician, whereby there's a very strong sense that he can shift his position quite quickly on a number of issues like Russia and Israel, but also when it comes to the EU. And I think one of the questions is, does the really hostile rhetoric that he's been using against the Netherlands, against Germany, you know, using words like Nazis and fascists and so forth, does that kind of close off any space for, does that, you know, create hard feelings that are really difficult to reconcile, or can those kind of be forgotten and papered over? So specifically on the case of Germany, I wanted to turn to our expert, Steve. In your paper that you've also just published with Brookings, you say that Germany is kind of a unique case. So we've been talking about Turkey-EU dynamics, but you focus specifically on Germany and say that the German-Turkish relationship is a unique one. Do you think that that is a uniquely challenged relationship? Does Germany have unique leverage over Turkey? Sort of how does that play in?
I agree. No, thank you for inviting me on this great panel and for doing the paper. No, I think that it's unique in the sense that, you know, you have over 3 million people of Turkish origin living in Germany, 1.2 million of whom can vote in the German elections, and about 1.7 million can vote in the Turkish elections. So that, and there's lots of important Turkish organizations working in Germany, including Gulenist organizations, but also AKP organizations. So there's a tremendous interconnection of societies between Germany and Turkey that I don't think exists in any other European country. So, and clearly, Germany is also the most important economic player in Turkey. And I think you can see on the refugee policy, Germany's been pulling the EU on a lot of key issues regarding Turkey. So I think if you look at the discussion there, I think the Germans have this view. They have this term partnership, which is really kind of a business-like relationship, but of course it's got to be a bit more than that. It's a very much an interest-based relationship, but because of this deep societal connection, it has to be a little bit more than that. And, of course, the Germans are taking the value issue very seriously in the rule of law. If you look at, I mean, in the paper I talk about the discussion in Germany, and I think the view there is that they take a long-term view, the long game, to use Derek Chollet's title from the book on the Obama policies. And this is, they wanted, I think, looking at what Volker Perthes, who's the, I think, one of the leading experts on the Middle East in Germany, the head of the Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik, he's argued for a Turkey policy and not an Erdogan policy. So he's thinking, you have to think long term. Don't forget that referendum was a close call.
And doctored.
And, you know, it could be that Erdogan could lose next year. I mean, it's not highly probable. He could stay for the next 10 years, too. But I think there is a sense that Germans have that, you know, you have to think beyond Erdogan. And the point that I think you made, Amanda, was to keep these societal relationships going below the top level because they are so deep. So I think, of course, the problem I think you see now in the German approach is domestic politics. Mm-hmm. And the recent election, well, not so recent, last September, it took only 6 months to build the government. But that means basically now you have a new government in Germany with the weakest chancellor that Merkel has been. This is the weakest. This is her fourth chancellorship, by far the weakest. She had to give up not only the foreign ministry but the finance ministry to the Social Democrats, and she had to take in her. And she has the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, this right wing party, which the outgoing foreign minister Gabriel has called. Sort of has neo-Nazis in it, but it's a very right-wing extreme party which has no love lost for Turkey or for Islam. But they are now the largest opposition party in the Bundestag. And you have the CSU, the Bavarian affiliate of the Christian Democrats, which are also very tough on these issues and on Turkey, so that you have domestic politics that's making it more difficult for Merkel and for the German government to take a longer-range approach because of these immediate pressures. And that's why you saw in the government declaration that she made last week, Chancellor Merkel overtly criticized Turkey on their policies in Syria. And also, I think that this, just to make the point here, that they don't have the abandonment option. I mean, talking to German diplomats, if you ask a German diplomat, is Turkey lost? They say, can't lose Turkey. It's not possible. We cannot lose Turkey. So I think that's an important point.
Okay. There's also a couple of other things that I think about, and I think this aspect of the large Turkish population in Germany is quite important, and sort of the tradition of the Gastarbeiter and this long institutional relationship that Germany and Turkey have. And then also the presence of some civil society groups, you know, like the Ottoman biker gang of Turks in Germany, yeah. Which I think is fascinating. There was a lot of praise and excitement with the release of Deniz Yücel from a Turkish-German journalist from Turkey and his return to Germany. But some would say that that's Germany kind of engaging Turkey in a form of hostage diplomacy and in some sense playing by Turkey's rules. Do you think that Germany, maybe the EU in general, but Germany specifically, has a greater set of options that it's willing to consider than the U.S., for example?
They have different kinds of options. I think what's interesting, the point is that the Germans don't really have security options. Okay. They did remove their base from Incirlik and moved it to Jordan, the Bundeswehr base, but that's not a huge issue for the Turks. I think the Germans are not as concerned or don't have the security levers. Mm-hmm. Their levers, as Kamal pointed out, are economic. Mm-hmm. They have over 7,000 German companies are operating in Turkey. When Erdogan put something like 680 German companies on a list that supports terrorist organizations because they were doing business with Gulenists, supposedly, he had to backtrack very quickly because he didn't want to lose that economic, you know, the economic prosperity that comes with German investment. So the Germans have a very strong leverage with economics. It's a longer-term sort of thing, and I think that they'll continue to use that. I think in addition to that, on the Yücel thing, I mean, I think that was going back to this, the use of transactional politics to get some sort of, some kind of engagement here. And I do think when we see what's happening today in Bulgaria, I would advocate that the Germans and the EU essentially cut a deal. Mm-hmm. In return for, again, some movement on rule of law, or at least on some of these hostages that are being held, to modernize the customs union, to go to visa liberalization, and to increase investment. Because the Germans have always taken the view, since Ostpolitik, of engagement. And they believe the long-term effects of engagement and of keeping the lines open to a broader society will eventually slowly begin to change the society. I think that's going to be their approach.
Okay. Excellent. Really fantastic insights. We have a great crowd here, so I want to make sure that we have enough time for questions. I have one last question that I'm going to ask to all of the panelists at the end, and I can ask it now so you can think about it. After the elections, whether they are moved up, and so they are held this year, potentially with the July 15th, second anniversary of the coup attempt falling on a Sunday, that might make a very auspicious day for elections, potentially, if one were strategizing. After those elections, does the playing field change? Whether it's Erdogan is president, as I think a lot of people believe that he will be, whether it's by hook or by crook, irrespective of what the coalition in the government looks like, is this a fundamentally different playing field with Erdogan and the AKP not worried about the 2019 elections? Are more options opened up? Okay. So we'll have you guys think about that. So I think we have a microphone that's going to come around. If you could just raise your hand, we're going to take a couple of questions and then have the panel answer them as a group. If you could just state your name and affiliation, and please make it a question, not a comment, and make it brief. Thank you very much. Yes, the gentleman here, please.
Thank you. Hi, Steve Flanagan from the RAND Corporation. Ambassador Edelman alluded to the possibility of some kind of way forward with the Turks on perhaps the most vexing policy issue we have with them on Syria. Last week, it appears that the Turkish government senior leaders said that they had some kind of, if not a deal, some kind of understanding with former Secretary Mattis and National Security Advisor McMaster. But then Heather Nauert also denied that there was such a deal. But clearly, there are some areas of common interest. And I'd be interested to hear how, particularly Eric, your comments, but others on the panel, how we might move forward. There has been suggestion that the Turks have, in fact, cooperated with the YPG in the past. We certainly have a common interest in offsetting Iranian influence in the region. But I'd be interested in your comments. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, to Dmitry, right here.
Thank you. Dimitri Saruhas at Bilkent University, Ankara, and visiting fellow Georgetown. A question on EU-Turkey relations, because Kemal Hoca talked about this extensively. Is it possible, do you consider the possibility of the Erdogan regime being able to play EU member states against each other? We talked about authoritarianism quite a bit. We know there are some regimes within the European Union that are tempted by this kind of politics. So is it possible that the transactional relationship that has been talked about applies to countries such as Germany that take the longer view, but at the same time, the Erdogan regime is aware of the fact that other countries will remain skeptical and therefore will be able to play them against each other. Thank you.
Okay. Excellent. Do we have one more? Yep, down here, please. Thank you very much.
I'm Harlan Ullman with the Atlantic Council and the Naval War College. I wondered if we could expand the aperture greatly and consider, are there some really big ideas, some of which may sound a little bit strange, but to consider, sort of Nixon going to China, Trump going to Pyongyang. For example, supposing the United States were to suggest recognizing Kurdistan and Iraq. The Montreux Convention is 82 years old. There are a couple of states who are not signatories who are now part of it. With leverage on Russia, is that a way to go? Are there other areas, for example, using Germany much more in the economic sense? In other words, some big ideas mm-hmm. that perhaps would be difficult to execute but might be able to change the relationship in a better way. I'd like your views on what you might consider.
Okay. Great. Let's use that as the first round of questions. Ambassador Edelman, do you want to start the Syria question?
Yeah. So, Steve, to your question, we've had since the rebellion in Syria broke out in March 2011, in my view, a sort of dialogue of the deaf with our Turkish friends and colleagues, and we've really talked past each other. We've had working groups that were set up under Secretary Clinton, but I don't think we've ever really engaged, you know, in the main issue. And to me, the main issue is less about the YPG and Rojava and what the future of Kurds in Syria is than what the future of the large Kurdish minority in Turkey is. That's the real issue. Mm-hmm. And there, I think, what we have failed to communicate to President Erdogan is that which he and his colleagues claim to be most afraid of, the creation of an independent Kurdish state or Kurdish secessionism inside Turkey, is more likely to be promoted by the policies they're following, particularly in southeastern Turkey, the siege of various Kurdish cities in the southeast, which in my view have alienated an entire generation of Turkish Kurdish youth, than working with us to arrange some kind of modus vivendi in northeastern Syria that takes into account the requirements that we've had in the counter-ISIS campaign to use the YPG, which has been the only effective fighting force. But bearing in mind that they've got security interests there as well. And I think, we had some experience with this. When I was ambassador, there was a tremendous amount of antagonism and angst on the part of Turkish leaders about the KRG and what was going on there. And if you look at what's happened, in fact, there's flourishing trade and investment between Turkey and the KRG, et cetera. So it's not like there's not a previous track record of being able to work through some of this, you know, if people are willing to sit down and actually have a serious strategic conversation. And I, by the way, I'm not just blaming the Turks here. I think we are equally to blame. I think we have not been willing to have that conversation either, and I think we should. I'll defer to my colleagues on the Turkey-EU question, but to Harlan's points, you know, there I think, Harlan, there was a chance before Barzani seriously misplayed his hand last fall with the referendum to play that card, maybe. But I think, unfortunately, that has made it almost impossible to do that. At this point now, we just have to sort of modulate the conflict that's going on between Baghdad and Erbil. So, you know, it was worth thinking about at one time, but I think the time for that may have passed by a little bit. On Montreux, I'm not quite sure how that cuts. It was our support for Montreux going back to 1946 that I think Kamal was adverting to when he talked about the long arc of the U.S.-Turkey relationship. And I'm just not sure how much, at this point anyway, mileage there is, particularly because at this point Turkey's relations with Russia are better than ours are, and so I think it's hard to make the diplomacy of that work.
To follow up quickly on the Syria question, you mentioned that the U.S. is kind of equally to blame in these tensions, and arguably the U.S.'s arming of the YPG is maybe the biggest sticking point or roadblock or obstacle in the U.S.-Turkey relationship. In terms of the mistakes that the U.S. made, I think one of them is mixed messaging. I think, you know, coming from different members of the government saying different things, saying they're going to stop arming the YPG, saying they're not going to. Do you think that the U.S. also underestimated how much Turkey perceived the YPG as a security threat?
I'll defer to Amanda on that because I wasn't in government.
I was going to go to her next.
I wasn't in government at the time, so I can't, you know, I can't really speak to what, you know, what our thought process, what the government's thought process was in doing that. Look, I think the reality that Erdogan and Turkey have to accept is that Kurds in Syria, I mean, Syria's Humpty Dumpty. I mean, Assad may have won the war, quote unquote, in the sense that he's still there, but I don't think, at least as long as U.S. forces are there, that they're going to completely reassert their control over the entire country. And as a result, the Kurdish population in Syria, no matter what, that's just a reaction. Is how can that be, moderated? How can that be regulated in a way that takes into account legitimate Turkish security concerns about its own border, et cetera? On the other hand, you know, one can also be a little cynical about Turkey's concern with the Syrian border, since it was something that for about 6 or 7 years they really didn't take seriously either, going the other way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I did want to move on to Amanda. If you want to sort of incorporate an answer to that question and your thoughts on that and U.S. missteps in terms of communicating with Turkey vis-a-vis the YPG and Syria, and then also any of the other questions that were asked, if you want to respond.
Yeah, I'll address some of the Syria issues and let the others deal with some of the EU issues. Let me say a couple things on this. First, I completely agree with Eric that the only way you're going to solve this overarching Kurdish problem is by having a reconciliation between the Turkish government and the PKK. Don't forget, Erdogan actually did start a peace process. You had a 2.5-year ceasefire by the PKK. You did have peace talks between the Turkish government and the PKK that ended up breaking down, I think, in part as a result of spillover from the violence in Syria. I think it's going to be very difficult in the run-up to the elections to resume those peace talks because of the way this plays with the nationalist base, but I think we shouldn't forget that there was a process at one point. on Steve's comment about the Turkish cooperation with the YPG, which I know comes up a fair bit, this was fairly limited tactical coordination when the Turks were removing this Suleiman Shah memorial within Turkey that was surrounded by ISIS forces. So I think that shouldn't be overplayed as Turkish YPG coordination in the broader fight against ISIS. There was just a reality that Turkish forces needed to cross through YPG-held territory to get the remains of this memorial and relocate it. But that coordination did happen on the ground. I mean, this has long been a tension within U.S.-Turkish relations, and certainly during the 3 years that I spent at the State Department managing Turkish relations, the subject was more discussed than almost anything else. I think the U.S. has done a disservice to itself and its own understanding of the issue by focusing very much on the legal distinction that it made between the PKK, which is a designated terrorist organization by the U.S. and the EU, and the YPG, which is not. And so that legal distinction separates the two groups and also was part of the basis for which the United States was able to cooperate with the YPG. The reality is that there are clearly very close connections between the groups. You have a movement of fighters between the groups. You have YPG forces in Syria that have pictures of Abdullah Öcalan, who is the leader of the PKK, which the Turks arrested with U.S. CIA help in Syria. So there's clearly connections between those groups. And I think in response to your question, the U.S. has not been as sensitive as it should have been to some of the legitimate security concerns that the Turks have. The Turks have also suffered more deaths over the years at the hands of PKK terrorist attacks than they have by some of these other ISIS-related groups. There's also, as you said, been very mixed messaging coming out of the administration on this. The Obama administration had been clear to the Turks that the YPG would be able to clear ISIS forces from Manbij and then would move east of the Euphrates, which was one of Erdogan's red lines from the beginning of this, because he did not want YPG forces to connect all of the cantons into a single autonomous Kurdish region, which would have run the length of the Turkish border and blocked off any other Turkish access in. There are still YPG forces that are in Manbij, and that is part of what is driving Erdogan's continued desire, now that they have captured Afrin, to move 60 miles to the east to clear Manbij of these YPG forces. There's also, as Liesl said, mixed messages now coming out of the Trump administration about what U.S. policy is going to be towards Syria and the Kurds. You have President Trump, who has told President Erdogan that the U.S. was going to stop arming the YPG after the Raqqa operation, which the Pentagon quickly corrected and said was not necessarily the case. You have the State Department indicating that cooperation with the YPG was going to be temporary and transactional. You then have Tillerson delivering a Syria policy speech at Stanford in Syria, which was talking about a longer-term U.S. security presence. And then you have the Pentagon, especially CENTCOM and U.S. Special Forces, who have been very clear in their comments in the media that they see the YPG as a strategic partner with whom they want to continue cooperating. So it is not a surprise that there is some confusion within the Turkish government about what U.S. policy actually is in Syria and what this means for long-term cooperation. So I think mistakes certainly have been made in the past. We are where we are now. I think it's going to be very important that the U.S. reach a diplomatic and some sort of military agreement with Turkey before we get into a situation where Turkish forces are pressing on Manbij and coming into military conflict with U.S. forces on the ground. But ultimately, I agree with the ambassador that we need to have a much more holistic approach to the situation of Kurds in the region and ultimately get back to some sort of peace process in Turkey.
Liesl, can I just say one thing? So I agree with what Amanda just said. The question is, you know, how do we have this discussion? And I think one thing, this goes to back to my basic point, we shouldn't think that we can, you know, solve this by sitting down and having a really happy discussion with the Turks and then that, you know, don't worry, it'll all work out. You know, let's, you know, not. This really requires, you know, some very serious thought ahead of time about what we think we need, what we think they need, how can we get there? And to the point about the breakdown of the peace process with Öcalan and the PKK, which is a very important point that Amanda just made, I don't want to absolve the PKK of its own responsibility for that breakdown. There were a series of attacks, et cetera, in the early summer of 2015. But I think it's impossible not to look at the domestic context of that decision and not to conclude that Erdogan fundamentally made a decision to go to war, not just with the PKK, but with the Kurds in southeastern Turkey at that point. And why did he do it? Because he had lost the election, essentially, in June of 2015, in the sense that, for the first time, AKP did not have a majority. He had a Kurdish party in the parliament. He lost votes to the MHP, which he had to steal back in his strategy, which was not to have a national unity government, as his prime minister wanted, but to go to another election in November, which he did. And he needed the military on side in his struggle with the Gulenists against the parallel state, as he would put it, inside Turkey. That's what drove the breakdown in the negotiations with the PKK. And the point we need to make is it's important for you to get back to that.
Right.
Because that's the only solution, ultimately, for you to have this problem. It's the one truly constructive thing Erdogan has done in his reign since 2003.
I think the
other thing that his comment made me think about is I mean, ultimately, this comes down to what U.S. strategy on Syria is going to look like. I think there is a tendency to talk about the YPG as though they represent all Syrian Kurds. They mm-hmm. don't. They are a faction of Syrian Kurds. So they don't even represent that entire group. Then you also have Russia. The YPG Kurds that the Turks have been attacking in Afrin have been backed by the Russians. They are not cooperating with the U.S. So you have Russians in there. And then you also have, in a lot of these areas, predominantly Arab towns who don't necessarily want to be governed by Kurds. So I think there's been a tendency to make this a very simple issue as U.S. versus Turkey versus Kurds. And I think it's actually far more complicated than that. It's far more nuanced, and there's a lot of actors that are involved in this bigger question.
I really appreciate you kind of parsing out the complexity of this Gordian knot of you know, how do you sort of manage these groups when there are all of these sort of intra-factional divisions, different sides supporting them. So I think it's really important to make sure that we don't have a very simplistic understanding of the issue. And then also the focus on domestic politics that you were pointing out, I think, is important. Yes, this is a panel on Turkey and the West, but there's so much of Turkey's foreign policy that's intricately tied up in domestic politics. And I think particularly the U.S. needs to understand that, you know, Turkey's commitment to the war in Syria, the war against the Syrian Kurds, is, yes, there's this legitimate security threat, but there's also an ability before the elections, and this is why I want that last question to kind of focus on what does the post-election atmosphere look like, but that the government is kind of able to thread this amazing needle of getting ethnic nationalists, religious nationalists, and secular nationalists on board by targeting the YPG. So, I think the U.S. needs to understand exactly sort of what are the dynamics behind Turkey's commitment to this. So I want to turn to the Turkey-EU questions now. Steve, do you want to pick up?
Sure. To Dimitri's question on whether the Turks can play off the Europeans against each other, you certainly saw when Merkel was pushing this EU refugee deal a lot of unhappiness and divisions, obviously, within Europe about it. But I think there's a clear consensus this is a good thing. The whole feeling right now in Europe on refugees and borders is what Macron said. We want an EU that protects. And basically, you're going to see a lot of emphasis on border security. And I think you'll see today something maybe will come out today in this meeting to have a deal which you'll extend the refugee deal, and maybe there'll be some other things thrown in. So I think there's a consensus in Europe. I don't see them. Where I can see the problem coming, I saw the new Austrian Chancellor Kurz came out today or yesterday in favor of just ending the negotiations with Turkey altogether on EU. And there's going to be pressures coming to sort of take that position. That's something I don't think Germany or France would go for at this point. But that could be an area. But I think it's going to be those kind of divisions. In terms of Harlan's question, I think instead of big ideas, I see a lot of little things are probably more likely to happen. For example, on the Turkish side, I think the best thing, easiest thing they could do is to get more flexible on Cyprus and on the military presence in Cyprus, which to me baffles me why they think it's so important to keep those troops in Cyprus. That would be a major card that they could play, which I don't think would cost Erdogan that much and could really open the door for some concessions on the European side. And I think also Russia will push Turkey back toward NATO, and because the Turks don't want to be out there on their own. But that's another reason why I think you have to have some strategic patience with them. On the German side, I would say that the interesting thing is on the economic side, there is an asymmetrical relationship. That is basically Turkey needs Germany a lot more than Germany needs Turkey. I've talked to a lot of German business people about this, and they feel that, well, it's nice to have this Turkish market, but it's not like it's that huge, where it's very much more important to the Turks. So they can use those levers, I think, a little bit there. Should Germany use the arms export issue? They export a lot of arms to Turkey, but that's a long-term thing. The final point I'd make is the issue of the coup plotters. I think the Germans need to take this more seriously. The German position has been that the Gulenists were not behind the coup. Listening to my people know Turkey better than I do. There seems to be a pretty strong case that there was some connections there. So all these people, there are something like, I don't know, 800 or something that are right now in Germany that are not being extradited. I think the German courts and the German government have got to take this a bit more seriously. And to take, there have got to be some people there that maybe should be sent back for legal reasons.
So I think the idea of countries kind of playing off each other is an interesting one. But in a sense, there's also a dynamic of, or I wonder if there's a sense that countries are kind of looking at that EU countries are looking at Brexit and seeing that, you know, some of the debates surrounding the Leave campaign had to do with, you know, immigrants coming. There was sort of an Islamophobic dynamic to it. We see that Merkel gets tough on Turkey during her own election campaign. Mm-hmm. Is there a concern that being tough on Turkey is good domestic politics, that might kind of shape EU dynamics?
Being tough on Turkey, yes, there's a lot of support for that, but there's also more support to keep the refugees out.
Exactly.
So I think there's a sense, okay, we can be tough on Turkey, but we can be realistic about the need that we need to keep have this deal with Turkey.
Hence transactionalism.
Right, transactional, absolutely.
Excellent. Kimon, to you.
I'd like to go back to that point about being tough. Mm-hmm. I agree with what Eric and Amanda have been saying in relation to Syria and the dynamics around there. But when the United States doesn't stand behind the words that it has given to the Turkish government, the Turkish side exploits it and uses it to fuel anti-Americanism and anti-Westernism. The message is a clear one. You can't trust it. And that message then is translated in public opinion surveys where, to my utter bafflement, Turkey, in the eyes of the public, the United States, comes up as a much bigger source of threat than Russia is, right? So there is that domestic politics dimension of that. In relation to the Kurdish issue, I would like to go back to your Gordian knot and the complexity in it. Now, you remember what happened in Kobane in the late summer and early fall of 2014. There were large numbers of Kurds who were let into Turkey eventually before an early moment of hesitation when they all kind of amassed right at the border. Now, a good portion of those refugees are still in Turkey. They are still sitting in refugee camps as well as urban centers right across from Kobane. The reason for it is that they are not the appropriate Kurds as far as PYD and YPG goes in terms of being let back into these Kurdish populated parts of northern Syria. I'd like to link that to what has constantly been coming up about a strategy for not only Syria, but for the Middle East. I mean, we were all hopeful about the Arab Spring, but the Arab Spring didn't deliver what we were hoping and looking forward to. Instead, it has ended up in a totally and utterly fractured Middle East of the kind that we hadn't seen in the troubled history of the Middle East. Now, that Middle East needs to be reconstructed. And one challenge in Syria is the demographic changes that have occurred, and some refer to it to ethnic cleansing. And Erdogan right now is addressing a public, both in Syria and in Turkey, in a manner where he's arguing that the status quo ante, the situation preceding the civil war in Syria, has to be recreated. You cannot always take it on its face value, but the principle of it is going to be very important, and that will have repercussions in terms of what form governance is going to take place in northern Syria. Before I go to EU-Turkey, I like the big ideas point about that. I think the West did have big ideas in the 1990s, as I pointed out. One big idea that was shared by the likes of Gerhard Schröder, Joschka Fischer, and especially late Anna Lindh from Sweden, was the notion that Turkey has a place in the Middle East. In the European Union, a Freudian slip there. As long as Turkey meets the Copenhagen criteria. And I lived those years. I saw how this line impacted on Turkish society, civil society, politicians, etc. That was a huge idea, and an idea very much loyal to the founder fathers of the European Union and the European integration project, if you're going to really achieve stability, peace, and prosperity. A lot of bridges were built in those 50, 70 years. That, to me, was a big idea, and that idea has faded away. There are good reasons to do with politics, etc. I would wish to see leaders emerging who can weave that idea back into place. And we must not also forget the role the United States played way back in the late 1940s in encouraging this European integration project. I doubt it would have materialized if it was not for characters like Dean Acheson, for example, pressuring also the German side, the French side, to work together on Jean Monnet's ideas. And they did the same thing in the mid-1990s, and it delivered. The U.S. ambassador to Brussels in the mid-1990s was working much more dynamically, effectively, than his Turkish counterparts in mobilizing EU support for the customs union in 1995-96, a very important turning point there. Again, in the late 1990s, the U.S. decision to cooperate with their Turkish parts to bring over Öcalan from Nigeria, Kenya, I think it was, to deliver to the Turkish security forces, and in return, clearly behind the scenes, a deal being struck that reform has to be introduced with respect to the Kurdish minority cultural rights, I think was a huge idea. There was a huge idea in this town that I'd like to think that I was fortunate to be on the margins of. It was TTIP. TTIP was going to be a big geostrategic exercise, not just a trade one. And I saw with my own eyes, playing on the margins, how this TTIP might impact on Turkey, and are there ways in which one could get Turkey involved in it. Had that materialized, it would really have been a huge idea, successful idea, and I suspect the world would be in a very different place than where it is actually right now. Coming on the EU to Dimitris's question.
Quickly, please. I want to see if there are more questions.
Yeah, very quickly. I kind of would go along with what Steve has said, but at the end of the day, the big ideas that Turkey would like to extract from the European Union, such as the customs union, such as an extension of the EU-Turkey migration deal, are going to have to be negotiated and agreed upon at the EU level. So following a Putinesque policy of divide and rule, yes, to a limited extent, but not in terms of achieving the big fruits that Turkey needs domestically in terms of economy, but also moving along with the migration deal. I have to underline just one very quick point. There are 3.5 million Syrian refugees in Turkey.
Right.
And in Europe, it's about 1 million. In a union of 500 million people and a huge, huge economy. That needs to be recognized and that needs to be addressed together with the spirit of burden sharing. And that's what the deal did. It was unfairly criticized when it came out. Yes, I understand it. But I think it also offers opportunity moving forward. And that I consider, again, as a whole EU deal rather than a deal with just between Turkey and Germany.
Exactly. So we'll have to see what happens at Varna today. Okay, other questions here? Yep, down in the front. Just wait for the microphone, please. And again, try to keep it brief. Thank you.
Hi, this is Safan, news correspondent for Anadolu Agency, Turkish news agency. And I do have actually two quick questions, one to Mr. Madelman. You, in your remarks, said Turkey and Erdogan against Kurds. And are you, I just want to ask you, I'm sure you're aware of it, but I just want to ask you here, are you aware of, that there are actually a lot of Kurds in AK Party by itself, along with Turkish government, one of the most important positions actually within the Turkish governments are actually Kurds. And what's your purpose of calling YPG or talking about YPG and calling them Kurds, especially while you're not? About my question. This is the first question, actually, if you're aware of...
I'm sorry, what's the second? I'm not quite sure I understand what the second part of the question. Are you suggesting the YPG is not made up of Syrian Kurds?
Yeah, well, you're calling YPG Kurds, and you said in your remark that Turkey or Erdogan against Kurds, and there are actually a lot of Kurdish people in AK Party and important positions in Turkey. Just want to ask your remark on that. The second question is... We've been talking about anti-Americanism in Turkey. It's increasing, increasing. And I just want to ask, isn't that enough, do you think, isn't that enough, the Washington support to YPG, PKK, according to CIA fact book and other generals, isn't that enough for tension, especially when we compare it to U.S. reaction and outrage against Russia? Due to Russia's meddling and intervening in U.S. Election.
Okay, and was that a question for a specific panelist or just
in general? Yes, actually, whoever.
Okay. All right. Next question, please. In the back, the woman in the back, please.
Ali Matley, visiting scholar at the American University. I'd like to know from the panelists how they assess the possibility/risk of Congress. Imposing sanctions on Turkey for concluding a weapons deal with Russia. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, and one more in the back. Actually, let's take this woman's question and then the one in the back, please.
Hi, Jennifer Miel with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Turkey Business Council. Thank you for a great panel and all your insights. Wondering about the Jerusalem decision for the United States and the embassy and Turkey's counter decision to open up an embassy in East Jerusalem. Could this be a potential way for us to collaborate on the peace process, or do you see nothing but negativity coming out of it? Thank you.
Excellent question. Thanks. And then one in the back, please, and then that'll be it.
Thank you. My name is Dilmon Abdul-Kader, director of the Kurdistan Project at the Endowment for Middle East Truth. Just quick comment before my question. It's very disappointing and false that we continue to give Turkey and Turks the victim card, because we tend to blame the Kurds with the PKK and link them with the PKK. But we have to understand why the PKK exists and that what happened between 1923 with the founding of Turkey up until 1984.
Okay, and the question,
so,
please?
There's a reason why the PKK exists.
The question, please?
And my question is, what can we expect with... Ambassador John Bolton's appointment and also Pompeo's appointment to with this administration. What can we expect with the reaction to Erdogan's aggressive and fascist war against the Kurds? Thank you.
Very good questions. Thank you so much. Okay, so we'll just go down the panel. And if you want to choose whichever question you want to answer, if you want to think about, so we won't have time for my question. If you want to think about if post-election we're going to see new opportunities open up, you can address that as well. Ambassador Edelman, you want to start?
So on the first question, it's one of the peculiarities of the Kurdish issue in Turkey that for a very long period of time, it wasn't even possible to describe the population as Kurds. They were referred to as Mountain Turks. And this was in a period when the then prime minister, later president of Turkey, was in fact partially of Kurdish heritage. And it was no, you know, there's the AKP has no monopoly on having Turks of Kurdish origin or heritage as part of its leadership. We're on a panel and, you know, we're all trying to make our remarks fit the time. I think all of us have been using a bit of shorthand here. But what I was talking about in my remarks, specifically about 2015, was a decision which I think President Erdogan made essentially to restart military operations and war in the southeast, and that's what I was referring to. With regard to the PKK, I have no particular truck for the PKK. I think it's waged a very brutal and violent insurgency in southeastern Turkey that's cost enormous amount of lives and treasure for Turks, for Kurds. But the only way to stop this is through a political process. And what I think is important is for the U.S. to be weighing in with President Erdogan to try and get him back onto the track of pursuing negotiations. Let me just make one other comment, and I'll let all the other questions pass to my colleagues, or maybe I'll try and hit the sanctions point. I think it's extremely important for the U.S. to keep its word when it's negotiating with foreign governments. I agree with Kamal. And I think in that regard, just a minimum amount of professionalism can help. I think it was appalling that Secretary Tillerson met with President Erdogan the last time he was in Turkey, shortly before he was cashiered, and did not meet with the U.S. chargé present, nor any other American diplomat present, mm-hmm. nor with a U.S. interpreter present.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
But entirely, at the mercy of President Erdogan's Turkish interpreter. That is just rank diplomatic malpractice. And you're obviously going to get differences of view about who agreed to what if you allow yourself to be, put in that position. On the anti-Americanism, unlike Kamal, I'm not puzzled by it at all. And the reason I'm not puzzled by it, I mean, first of all, U.S. standing in public opinion in Turkey has never been that high. Yeah. Even in the best times of the U.S.-Turkish relationship, including in the 90s. But since 2002, certainly since 2003 when I arrived as ambassador, for 15 years nonstop, the media, it started essentially with the Islamist media, Yeni Shafak, Vakit, Milli Gazete, but now has spread beyond that to the media controlled by the president's cronies and in-laws, and soon with the sale of the Doğan properties, there won't be anything left, of an independent media, even as pitiful as it was in terms of independence. But that media for 15 years has relentlessly indulged in the worst kind of anti-Semitic, anti-American slanders, and criticism of the United States. I'm only surprised our standing in Turkish public opinion is as high as it is.
Mm-hmm. Just wait. Okay, Amanda?
I have a few thoughts. I agree with Ambassador Edelman. It was actually Çavuşoğlu who translated.
Yeah.
Wasn't
yeah.
even a,
interpreter,
a professional interpreter.
Oh, better, right.
and I also agree, that anti-Americanism, anti-Westernism is not a new thing in Turkey. So this predates and is entirely separate from American cooperation with YPG. It's just provided one more thing for the media to focus on. I wanted to say a word on the question about sanctions. Congress, there is already legislation in place that would enable the administration to sanction Turkey if it goes forward with the S-400 deal. Congress passed last year the CATSA sanctions, and there is a provision in CATSA that prohibits other countries from making significant defense transactions with Russian defense entities. So that would already provide the basis for the administration to sanction Turkey if this S-400 deal goes forward. I know there's talk in Congress about doing other things. I think one of the things that didn't come up in this, but I think like Kamal and others, I've also been talking with people in Europe. And what has been particularly striking is that there tends to be a difference in where executive branches are, which I think the British government, the Germans, the EU Commission, the U.S., broadly are looking at this idea of engagement, wanting to do something to preserve the relationship. But you have parliaments in very different places. And I think for the same reason that Turkey has domestic politics, other countries also have domestic politics. Steve talked a lot about that within Germany. You see that with the European Parliament taking much stronger stances in terms of talking about wanting to freeze accession with the EU. And you also see that playing out in the United States with Congress becoming increasingly frustrated with Turkish behavior. So short answer is there is already legislation in place to sanction on the S-400s. I think there is continued thinking within Congress about whether or not they want to take further measures.
Steve?
Sure. Interesting on the Jerusalem embassy issue. That's the one place where the Turks can agree with the Europeans on that. So, but then you have the Cyprus gas issue. So, I mean, I'm not sure how that plays out. On the Bolton-Pompeo impact, let's all wait and see. I mean, God only knows. It's certainly it's hard to say. It's not positive in Europe, that's for sure. But on your question on the post-election, just to end on that, the German coalition agreement on Turkey basically freezes everything right now until there's movement on rule of law and human rights. And you have a new government, and probably the person who was closest to the Turks was the foreign minister, Gabriel, who was actually had a formerly married to a Turk, goes to Turkey a lot. He's gone. And so you have Merkel, who's been weakened substantially, in part largely because of the refugee issue. So I think you won't see much movement on the German side until after the Turkish election, unless Erdogan really does something dramatic.
Thank you. Kemal?
Very quickly, I'd like to nuance, Eric, what you said about anti-Americans.
You don't think I'm nuanced? Oh, my God. I don't do nuance.
We must remember that Obama went to Ankara in April 2009 and made a speech in the Turkish parliament and received a standing ovation. We must also not forget that Bill Clinton came and spent the longest number of days in Turkey compared to past presidents and ended up having his nose squeezed by that little baby when he was visiting an earthquake-stricken neighborhood in Turkey. I would argue these things go up and down. And when USS Missouri arrived in the harbor of Istanbul, the reception was somewhat warm and the legacy still hangs out there. It's not God-given that anti-Americanism will not change in Turkey. Politicians play an important role in it. Events, the context plays a role in it. But I have, for my book, interviewed lots of people, lots of former diplomats, officials, etc. And there is a recognition that Turkey became a kind of lighthouse, a reference point, enjoyed prestige, etc. in its neighborhood and beyond because of its connections to the West, not in spite of them. On Amanda's point about domestic politics in Europe, I totally agree with it. There, too, we must not forget how the European Parliament voted in favor of opening accession talks with Turkey with the sign Evet, Ya, We. So it's the context that plays a very important role. Quick point about Jerusalem. If I'm not mistaken from my PhD years, there has always been a consulate in East Jerusalem of Turkey. So it's not about opening a new one. It's just highlighting it. Your, very quickly, the question you asked about elections and what will happen. My humble opinion is that Turkey is deeply divided. And unless somehow, if indeed, as the speculation goes, the current president is reelected and he pulls out of the back this white rabbit that he did in 2003-2004, when the whole country really had high expectations from him and from AKP, I don't see how those wounds are going to be healed just as a result of one election. There are huge challenges, and they're there, and addressing them in itself is going to be a challenge.
Excellent. In closing, I guess I just want to add a little bit more nuance to the anti-Americanism. And I, despite some of the warmer overtures, I think that a lot of Turks have a very long institutional memory. And even if they are pro-Western, you know, there's a suspicion of the United States that's not new under the AKP, that anti-Americanism is not something new. And it's amazing how many Turks know what the Johnson letter is.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So there's...
But can I add one tiny little...
Okay.
In an event we had here... A good friend and colleague of mine, Hakan Yılmaz, shared with us the results of a very recent public opinion. When Turks were asked, given an opportunity, where would you travel abroad? Guess where they would travel abroad? The European Union and here, not the other countries in the neighborhood. I don't want to mention that. That says a lot in spite of... the remark that you made. The reality is a bit more.
This may be the only panel on Turkey that I've ever concluded on a positive note. So I'm very happy to see that. Thank you so much to the panelists. Thank you guys for coming. Please give them a hand. Good job.